So let me introduce now James Duncan. So Jim is at Yale University, the Ebenezer Hunt Professor of Biomedical Engineering and a Professor of Diagnostic Radiology and Electrical Engineering. He's also the Director of Undergraduate Studies in Biomedical Engineering and Vice Chair for Bioimaging Sciences at Yale. His research efforts have been in the areas of computer vision, image processing, medical imaging, with an emphasis on biomedical image analysis and image-guided surgery. Jim is one of the founding co-editors-in-chief of the journal Medical Image Analysis. He was the general chair of MICAI conference in 2005. Jim is a fellow of the American Institute for Medical and Biological Engineering and a fellow of IEEE and of the MICAI Society. In 2013, he was elected to the Council of the Academy of Radiology Research, and in 2014, he was elected to the Connecticut Academy of Science and Engineering.
Jim? Thank you, Nicola. And it's a pleasure and an honor to be here listening to all these interesting talks. So I'd like to talk today generally about model-based strategies for recovering information from biomedical images, but I'm going to use a particular example to illustrate this based on recovering left ventricular strain from ultrasound images or echocardiography. So I'll try to sort of talk about the general problem first off. And I think, as I look at these talks, I think there'll be some interesting bridges here. We're using, again, sparse representations and dictionary learning, as Daniel talked about, and Olivier. And then we're using biomechanically inspired models in a couple of cases, like Peter Hunter was talking about. But in general, I'll talk about using geometrical models for recovering or segmenting structure, and then physically motivated models for recovering soft tissue deformation. So here's the way I guess our lab sees the problem, as many do. We have a four-dimensional data set, ultrasound images of the left ventricle of the heart moving over in 3D over time. And we want to get to some kind of quantitative parameters at the output that are going to describe or diagnose heart disease or be indicative of how heart disease progresses in this case. And this is an ill-posed problem, as you all know, to get through this chain of detecting features and processing things to get to parameters. So we use models to constrain the situation, constrain the recovery. And the models are, well, as you all know, different kinds of models are useful for quantitative image analysis, anatomy and structure, for instance, shape and appearance, size and shape of normal and abnormal structure, functional information, maybe motion and deformation characteristics. And the models might come from geometry, functional relations, physics, and in our world, that's inspired by anatomy and physiology. So if the left ventricle is the main pumping chamber of the heart, it takes reoxygenated blood and pushes it back out into the arterial system to supply organs and the rest of the body. One of the things it does is it feeds back on itself reoxygenated blood. One of the key vessels to do this is the left anterior descending artery. And it's sort of a bullet-shaped organ, in a sense, with a finite thickness. And if this is a cut through that, an axial cut through that in cartoon, and if you eat too much junk food, perhaps, this will block off and it begins to necrose or disease, the tissue starts to harden and get destroyed on the inner wall of the heart, the endocardium, and progresses out to the endocardium transmurally. And so we'd like to have an imaging technique, an analysis technique that can quantify this progression of disease. And also, if you get in and maybe intervene with a stent or some kind of unblocking therapy, you could see the recovery of this information. The data we're using is four-dimensional ultrasound, as I said. So we acquire data both from dogs in an animal lab as well as humans using a Philips IE33 scanner with a matrix array probe. So this sweeps out a three-dimensional volume with ultrasound beams. And here are some of the acquisition parameters. Perhaps the key thing, it's about a sort of a millimeter cubed light resolution. And we can image in 3D or in 4D at 33 to 40 hertz frame rate, so not too fast. Animal hearts, you have to image a lot faster. And we're doing this in 3D. Here's the acquisition chain from the transducer through this early signal processing through commercial image formation by Philips, and then output here what's called a B-mode image that you see here. It's envelope detection of the retrieved information, reflected ultrasound information. And here's the cuts through that sort of two vertical dimensions and the axial dimension. This donut is the myocardium and the blood is in the middle. Interestingly, and I'll talk about it in a second, we also pick off the information with a special board, that hardware board that Philips made for us to get at the raw radio frequency information for reasons I'll explain in a second. And in fact, here's our algorithmic processing chain. Here's the scanner. It's the probes put up transthoracically through the under the rib cage for humans, sort of just under the rib cage for dogs that we're imaging. And we have these two chains with what we feel is complementary information that's derived. And one chain uses the B-mode data, and we use this to look at surface information to try to recover the inner surface, the endocardium, and the epicardium, the outer surface, and use that to get at displacement information at the boundaries. And these specular surfaces are seen quite nicely, or reasonably nicely, from the commercial B-mode envelope detected data. But we can't see things well in the middle of the wall here, in our view. So we go to the raw RF. And this has, in the beams, there's a phase as well as a magnitude, and it's the phase tracking and the reflection off the internal tissue structure, the so-called speckle structure in the myocardium that we use to track in this chain. And I'll talk about work with Matt O'Donnell at University of Washington that does this. So it's putting together red displacements at the boundaries with green displacements here. This doesn't get good information at the boundaries due to the acoustic interfaces between blood and myocardium in background. And then we sort of use geometric models in this chain and sort of other signal processing models here and try to put it together with integration strategies that I'll also talk about in a second, motivated from biomechanics. And the key application here is to look at the heart at rest and stress here and look for trying to find hidden myocardial injury. So we're putting together displacements from these two pathways to get a dense set of displacements to then calculate strain. So the first path is to use geometrical models in the B-mode to get at boundaries. And this is age-old work in our lab on object segmentation. And sort of a recent progressions look first at using Bayesian strategies to try to find the surface at time t by gathering up features from image information from 1, that should be t minus 1. And so we turn this around with Bayes' rule. There's a likelihood data adherence term and a prior term that really uses this so-called dynamic shape prior that I'll talk about in a second. The data then first, this is the B-mode data now. We model that basically as different types of Rayleigh distributions, or as sort of a combination of them called a Nakagami distribution. And these, by the way, all of this information is going to be put together in a level set strategy, so distance functions to estimate the zero level set to find surfaces. The data adherence then uses these three different Nakagami distributions in combination, but they're really looking at on either side of an evolving surface using this Chan and Vasey surface evolution technique, if you're familiar with the level set world. The prior information is assembled with point distribution models, but in a multilinear subspace, or a decomposed multilinear subspace. The idea is that we might could manually trace out the endocardium and epicardium tediously over hours of 40 or 50 data sets, or we might sort of seed this with a piece of our automated algorithm, and then anchor everything using point distributions, sampling these surfaces to one point. And each one of these is a patient evolving over time, and this is different points in the cardiac cycle. So we decompose that into this multilinear subspace of subject by motion by landmarks. And then we can then take the information from one single subject up to time t minus 1, project it into this space, and pull back a prediction for the surface at the next point in time, finding the nearest things in the database that looks like what that should be based on the first 0 to t minus 1 pieces of information. We then put that in this sort of dynamical shape prior, actually Gaussian-like setup, and try to say that find a surface that then roughly adheres to what's pulled back from the database using an L2 norm. So we have a variety of results on this, especially in animal studies, over using 22 frames over the cycle, sort of a coarse resolution of the dotted lines. The manual showing dotted lines for the end of the epicardium. This is a slice through a three-dimensional frame just to show qualitatively what goes on. And quantitatively, testing on 15 open chest canine studies using these three error measures using the data from the Phillips system, that we call this a subject-specific dynamic model. And it did better than two-frame prediction or single-frame sort of gross statistical shape models. As you'll see, the MAD and the Hausdorff should be lower here and the percentage of true positives higher. And it worked out pretty well for these two surfaces. But all of this is done with a lot of training over hours and hours. The processing on this takes even a half hour, maybe up to an hour for a 20-frame data set. So we were motivated to look at another strategy using appearance, and we were interested in looking at dictionaries and sparsity to solve this problem. And in this approach, we just take information at one time frame, noting that at different scales, we can roughly get a coherence of the BMO textural patterns over time from frame to frame, and set it up with a multi-scale sparse representation and dictionary learning. The initial idea here was to just segment something at time one and then propagate it using dictionaries and sparsity over the rest of the times. And we were able to get that down to significantly less computation time, as in a couple of maybe 5-10 seconds per frame. And it works pretty well. Let me just explain that a bit. So the initial idea might be to hand segment, or maybe use some coarse idea to segment the first frame, and then train dictionaries of blood pool, myocardium, and background, two at a time. And the dictionary words are set up by looking at a 3x3x3, and then a multi-scale idea, 5x5x5, 7x7x7 box on either side of the surface, and take that and take a 3x3x3 and make it a 1x9 word, and take about 100 randomly sampled words on either side of the surface. And then we want to sparse code everything else as training samples in that, and learn a dictionary for blood pool, myocardium, and then or myocardium and background, and then pass that to the next frame, do a residual test, and embed that in a level set framework, and then sort of find the new surfaces, endocardium, epicardium, and pass that along. We use this three sets of scales and thought of each one as a weak learner and put it together with an Attaboost-like framework and combining the multiple scales in that way. So the whole idea is a back and forth between sparse coding using, I show here an L0 norm, I think we use an L1 norm in practice, and dictionary learning, updating a dictionary. So taking the 100 random samples, for the first dictionary, then looking at other random samples, maybe 100 or 200 on either side of the boundary, initialized, use orthogonal matching pursuit to do the sparsity calculation, get a residual for that from the training samples, and then update the dictionary by replacing one of the columns. This is using this K-SVD technique that maybe some of you are familiar with, single value decomposition K, and then iterate this by replacing a column, redoing the sparsity, compute the residuals, and learn the dictionaries for each of the classes. So here's sort of the dictionary is at a coarse, medium, and fine scale for blood pool and myocardium. I don't know, the coarse scale maybe separates a little bit. It's hard to see visually too much what's going on. So the learning goes on through this first step, as I was just talking about. Then once we have appearance classes, we pass it to the next dictionaries for each appearance class. We pass that to the next frame in the sequence and test a set of points everywhere and use you could use any kind of classification. We use this residual idea. I think it was Guillermo Shapiro, in fact, that at least I saw in the literature that looked at this. And once you compute the residuals, you look for the smallest residual, as the one that you decide is the tissue type that you'll classify that new voxel at the next time point into. And so these residues are used to do the classification, and that sets up a distance surface that you embed in this level set function. So we're seeking now a level surface phi, looking for the zero level set at the next time frame for pairs of classes, myocardium and blood pool, myocardium and background in this term, and the other terms just adhere to the Rayleigh intensity distribution. This passes a surface shape from the last one and an overall smoothness constraint. And so here's 16 or so, something like that, or maybe it's about 8 or 9 of a 20-frame sequence. And it does a pretty good job getting the endocardium and epicardium. And now down in about 5 to 10 seconds per 3D frame, which is about 250 by 250 by 250 voxels over 22 frames. So in a few minutes now, or maybe 5 minutes, not real time yet, but getting faster. And we're thinking about combining the shape-based priors if we can get it in there quicker. But this technique's working pretty well. And here it's showing that it works comparably to the subject-specific models that I talked about before. This is the results here, so it's pretty comparable and certainly better than using just Rayleigh and a single surface constraint alone. So now we have these surfaces, and we use these as context to find shape tracking information at the boundaries in order to get displacements about the myocardial walls, and use it as a rough constraint on what you'll see in a second to guide interior speckle tracking from the RF. So here's the processing chain again. I just talked about this piece. Now I'm going to talk a bit about this piece and how to put it together. So we've been working for a while on using the idea of just preserving local shape from frame to frame in a cardiac sequence. Here, this is a differential geometry-like problem. Take the principal curvatures at local surface patches. And here you see green-coded as the amount of bending more highly curved regions that it takes a lot of bending energy to bend away from flat, and white is the flatter regions. And the idea is to pick up each little piece here from these detected surfaces at very small samples around the heart, the walls of the endocardium and epicardium, and send out a plausible search region and match those local curvatures, again, using just basically differences of average principal curvatures. And you can end up over time with this needle map. We've done this years ago and continue to use ideas right around this, where the displacements are the surface tracked information locally. As I said before, in the middle of the wall, obviously we can't use boundary information or shape information, so we go to the raw RF speckle tracking, looking for speckles developed in the middle of the myocardium. It doesn't work well at the acoustic interfaces. And Matt O'Donnell at University of Washington has been working on this for years in the world of elastography, sort of palpating things with sound waves, looking for stiffness properties. And he just runs a collection of gate array correlators on the ultrasound beams, both along the beam and across the beam, does some correlation filtering and Viterbi-like filtering to end up with correlation coefficients. And so it's correlations with a sort of a weighting inside the myocardium. If you took a cut through a three-dimensional frame and looked at a couple of small views of it here, this is the myocardium and the blood pool in here. That's looking at the BMO data. This is computed from the RF. And they're sort of a mid-myocardial wall correlate, a pretty high correlation coefficient between a couple of frames. And you can just overlay this on top of the three axial elevation lateral readouts and get high accuracy displacement values from these correlations, basically tracking the phase, as I said. And we use that for the mid-wall displacement estimation. So now we need to put this together, the displacements at the boundaries and the displacements in the middle of the myocardium. And we first started doing this by using these detected epicardial and endocardial surfaces and running a meshing algorithm. And inspired by work, at least by Peter and Andrew McCulloch especially, essentially used simple linear elastic models on these nodes using material matrices that looked like this, basically with a 4 times a long fiber versus a cross fiber stiffness assumption. We even overlaid, not really subject specific, but canonical fiber coursing maps on top of this at diastole. And the idea then is to take these displacements, here you see just the boundary endocardial boundary-based displacements, and pull on this meshed information where the material matrices, using also an incompressibility assumption of a Poisson ratio of about 0.4 on this, and abacus using finite element computational techniques to get a dense set of information. And sort of here's a piece of the myocardium just deforming based on those displacement values. So you could, this is really, you could set this up as a Bayesian problem of getting a dense set of displacements U from adhering to a sparse set of displacements UM, smoothed by what amounts to this material matrix embedded in a stiffness matrix K, pre and post multiplied by a strain displacement Jacobian. And really, you could think of this as sort of a Gaussian-like, Markov-like term on the material parameters. And if you sum over all elements, you can basically solve this analytically. It says, give me a dense set of U's everywhere that adhere to the sparse U's, maybe by their confidence values, how unique the shape matches and how strong the correlation coefficients are. And then using the simple linear elastic model embedded in K here as the strain energy smoothing function and solve that for U. So I the only slide I had in this was using the same idea on MR, but it illustrates the idea. Here's the normal canine heart. Take the bullet-shaped left ventricle, turn it on end, slice off the base and the apex, and then look at the radial strain in this case. You could get strains in any, it's a strain tensor that's computed, so you could get any direction you wanted. And here it is at diastole through different stages to systole, and you get approximately uniform stretching radially in all directions, about 25% from this dog heart. And then 1 hour post-LAD, post left anterior descending artery occlusion, you see that in the region that's fed by this, there's a set of zero to slightly negative strains, patterns that develop in the anterior apical wall where the infarction was caused due to this blockage. We did a bunch of tests on dogs. Here's one result from 6 dogs, just showing that we could at least statistically distinguish infarcts or injury that was halfway across the wall from totally across the wall as a first step. But as we got more serious about this and wanted to move towards something that was computationally feasible and a little less complex computationally, as Peter was talking about, went to an idea of trying to look at meshless strategies as opposed to doing the meshing, which can be quite computationally challenging and not even always so accurate as you get certain corners around like papillary muscles and things. So we decided to look at a strategy based on radial basis functions where it's sort of a mesh-free like technique where we started by just trying to look at coarse, medium, and fine scales to do the interpolation between gathering up high confidence information at the boundaries in the midwall. So here's the two pathways again, and we just integrate it with radial basis functions. Here's sort of a gross, kind of the red again are the shape tracks, the green, the speckled tract, RF information. You can see circles here in 2D just trying to interpolate to a dense set of displacements. Here's the actual displacements that I keep showing, the red, the boundary, and the pink, the B-mode boundary-based, and the green, the RF-based that we're trying to put together. And it amounts to sort of assembling information with different position centers and widths on these radial bases weighted in different ways. So we did this in a pretty deterministic way as a first step, and just recently published a paper that's coming out this month in, I think it was TMI, and we compared it not so much as, we've run these things through implanted markers on dogs to try to get local sparse, or sort of local regions to show that we have accurate strains. But as sort of a silver standard on these 8 or 10 dogs, we did both ultrasound, 3D ultrasound imaging, and MR tagging. MR tagging is a technique that looks visually quite nice. You lay down these saturated tags and it follows the motion. And I think it's not, we feel that the ultrasound's a more clinically viable direction in many ways, but MR tagging is something to compare to and something that people visually like. So we did this in four layers using the HARP MR tagging scheme, compared to what I just showed you using radial basis functions in a more sort of fixed way looking at the scales. And in 6 sectors at 4 levels, these 6 sectors around the heart wall at 4 levels on the myocardium, we got pretty good median correlation coefficients in the radial and circumferential strains. The MR tagging didn't do so hot with the longitudinal strain, even though we were able to get it. The interesting thing is if you look over time development in an infarct zone and then a normal zone, the MR and the ultrasound derived information tracks pretty well. We also were able to show in these sectors that when you combine two techniques, this integrated technique, there were better correlation values than if you use just the shape on the boundary alone or the speckle in the middle of the wall alone. So we're quite happy with this and trying to move forward on it. And in fact, the direction we're moving now is to try to continue to build on these techniques using thinking about doing it in a more principled way or somewhat more principled way. And radial basis functions have an interesting tie to the sparsity world and thinking about dictionaries. So we actually re-parameterize this information as weights on a set of a collection of radial basis functions assembled in a matrix H. And you could think of that as solving for, I just say WX weights XY, you could add Z here, by saying adhere the new set of dense U's again to the shape by an L2 norm, to the speckle by an L2 norm, and then have sparsity or shrinkage constraint norms, L1 norms on the parameter search to try to find the radial basis functions in this way. So you're finding a set of radial basis function weights that agree with this data and are sparse. Our first attempts at this are sort of using just 3 scales and assembling these, each midpoint of a radial basis function and its spread can be written out as a column vector of weights, and here's the coarse, medium, and fine scales, and then trying to sort out which of these vectors represent a collection of fields, so a collection of vectors. So here we're using sparsity to interpolate, basically, or to get to a dense field of displacements, just doing the radial basis function that we started with, but moving towards doing it in this dictionary and sparsity way. So sparse coding with radial basis functions, the greens and the are all the underlying data. Here's an interpolation using a fairly sparse set of yellow and green and red radial basis functions to get to this dense field. If you'd set the initializations wrong, though, you can get a couple of different answers here. That's not good. So we have the idea of trying to train on these collections of fields and training a sparse set of vectors over some data sets to then learn about what might be an appropriate representation that we could use as a model in a normal and an infarcted case. And we've just begun to explore this idea, but I think it's promising, and I'm pretty interested in going that way. Here's some thresholded mid-wall speckle track green information and boundary-based yellow information sort of on a mask within the surface, interpolated just in 2D to a dense field, trying to show that it yields plausible values in this local region, just using 2D slices as an initial attempt at this. And then finally, really the radial basis function setup that we have now is really almost just geometrical interpolation. So we'd like to get the biomechanical information back into the problem. And our first attempt at this is to just add a divergence free constraint to the weight finding functions with the sparsity norms and the L2 data adherence norms. And this is just work in progress, but we've noticed in the literature that there's some relationships here in other worlds and in other types of problems that people have already solved. Finally, here's the sort of the setup of where we want to go. This is we gather 3D information. This is on a piece of a dog heart. Here's where the probe is, and we're looking in only so deep to get part of the myocardial wall. And here it is imaged at time one and time two. So in each case, there's a sequence of 22 frames gathered at rest and then after stress. And this might be somebody running on a treadmill or injected with dobutamine, a stressing agent. And the idea is that this is indicative of a prior myocardial infarction that you would see if somebody just came in and was imaged at rest. But the real issue is, can you uncover hidden sort of states in here or more in here that develops after stress? And so here, if you do the difference of this, the color maps aren't so hot, but you actually can uncover in this sector some pretty good pattern of underlying extra myocardial injury or at least abnormality of the strain patterns that we'd like to then point the clinicians to. And we do this sort of six sector mapping and aiming at quantifying this and have a set of both animal and human experiments set up to look at this. And I think this is a post-mortem slice through a dog heart, a stain, histochemically stained post-mortem slice, just showing that the true infarct in the surrounding peri-infarct zone and the normal zone do distinguish pretty well in terms of average, in this case, radial strain values. So we're encouraged that this will be diagnostically helpful and indicative of injury and recovery of injury. So we've been working for a while on this. We're mostly still using normal models. We like to develop abnormal models and moving towards these sparsity ideas and radial basis function coding. We only have frame-to-frame temporal continuity. We need to look at how we're going to bring this together in a complete loop over the entire cardiac cycle. And we're trying to move towards core algorithmic principles in terms of reduced complexity, but still getting biomechanical and appropriate geometric constraints into the problem. We like looking at sparsity and even the segmentation, maybe shape theory, but biomechanics is another piece of it. And this is a never-ending problem of validation and evaluation. We work with animal models, so we're able to do certain implanted markers and tests, but then we want to validate it ultimately in vivo on humans. And so far, I guess it's the initial step is plausibility and reproducibility that the clinicians will go along with. These are interdisciplinary groups that work on this. Al Sinousis is the cardiologist that's been my collaborator for many years. Matt O'Donnell, the ultrasound expert. Samita Sampath was one of Jerry Prince's students that was with us for a while and understood the MR tagging and the HARP ideas. The rest of the folks are mostly from our image analysis lab. And we're funded by NIH. I'd like to thank them. And we've begun to try to put this software on an open software site that we call locally Bioimage Suite. My colleague Xenios Papadimitris has been developing this, and this is meant to be a conduit between research code and clinical research studies. And you can download it if you'd like, and we're trying to get our latest ideas into there. Thank you very much.